Good morning. Monday. A very good day.
And we go straight this lunchtime to the news that's just been breaking in the last hour that a vaccine jointly developed by Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech was 90% effective in preventing COVID-19 infections in ongoing phase 3 trials.
Now, wasn't that the good news we've all been waiting for? And yes, there are caveats, and yes, we need to see the data, and yes, there will be all kinds of horse trading and wrangling. But just for now, hope. Brian Dobson on the News at One spoke to Dr. Anne Moore, Senior Lecturer in UCC School of Biochemistry and Cell Biology.
And the significance of reporting a 90% effectiveness at this stage on a trial of this scale, what is the importance of that? What kind of breakthrough does that represent?
Well, I guess to clarify, they're looking at it, this is an interim analysis, which means that they've looked very early on at only a small cohort of people who have actually been diagnosed as COVID positive. So this actually is only looking at 94 individuals, not at the whole 43,000. That would be very, very difficult in such a short space of time. But in the people who have been in those 94 cases of COVID-19, what they can say is that there was 90% fewer infections in the vaccinated population. So, you know, 9 or 10 of the infected are vaccinated, and the other 80 plus people are in the control arm, the placebo arm of the trial. So it is an interim analysis, but it is very, very positive news that even in that, it is significantly different. It does show that there are significantly fewer cases when you're vaccinated. And this is 7 days after the second immunization of these individuals. Mm-hmm. So we do need to see how long that can protect for as well. But it is a really significant finding. It's very positive. This is the first breakthrough we have that a vaccine can protect against SARS-CoV-2 infection. So it is very positive.
And all the virology greats were out on this one, and pretty much all of them welcoming the news, albeit with caveats, you know the drill. On Morning Ireland, Mary Wilson asked the WHO's Dr. David Naparo if this development might be a game changer.
We need several vaccines. I don't think just one vaccine will be enough. And we're watching a number going through what we call phase 3 clinical trials. This is one that's in the middle of the trials, and we've had advanced notice that it's particularly effective. This is great, great news, but I'm looking forward to more coming through, and I expect during next year we will get some of these vaccines being licensed and then they can be made available. I'd just like to say two things. First of all, we can't change what we've been trying to learn to do during the past few months, just overnight, because there's a vaccine. We've got to go on treating the virus with respect and adjusting our lives so that it's less easily able to be transmitted. We've also got to go on building up defences in our communities, just like what you're doing in Ireland, particularly in the context of the current movement restrictions. But then we add the vaccine in, it becomes part of the collection of interventions, and it will make a huge difference. I just don't like the word game changer. It's what we've been expecting to come. It's one of the developments, and it has to be incorporated into our response processes in the due course of time. We must not give up our work, our direction that we're on at the moment.
Oh, fair enough. Maybe push that disco glitter ball back under the bed for now. But when Professor Sam McConkie spoke to Claire Byrne, he went for a car analogy.
I see this vaccine as a little bit like a seatbelt in our motor cars. It's not the total answer to safe driving. We also have to have good roads and safe cars that don't have a steering column that's broken. We also have to not speed and not get drunk as we drive. So a seatbelt is just one of multiple tools. And unfortunately, the vaccines will just be one of multiple tools. So we're still going to need testing and tracing and outbreak investigation and all the standard toolbox that we've been using. Now, I hope we don't need level 5. What I hope is that this vaccine is a tool that avoids us getting and staying in level 5. None of us like level 5, and it's a very unpleasant place to be. And hopefully this tool will help us to be at a lower level. I wouldn't like to say normal. I think life is never going to go back to 2019. It's just a different world we're in. But I hope get back to a very normal-ish, satisfactory new life.
What level do you think will be our forever normal?
It's too difficult to say. It depends on how good a tools we have. I think if we've this and then maybe some small molecules, some tiny little drugs have really helped us to control hepatitis C and HIV. And those over the next 3 to 5 years, I think we'll have small molecules that will also really control SARS-2 and COVID very well. So when we've that plus a vaccine, plus we understand more about the specific tools of how to prevent transmission, I think we'll get back to well, I would hope somewhere between level zero and level one. I hope it'll be less than level one. Level one, sadly, is only 10 people from 3 households. That's still really restrictive. I don't really feel comfortable. So I'm really hopeful we'll get back to something between level zero and level one.
And this question sent in from listener David was one that perhaps many were asking.
He's had a couple of conversations already with people who are adamant that they will not get the vaccine because they're sceptical about how quickly it was developed and they won't know what side effects there might be, possibly months or years down the line. How confident can we be that the vaccine has been safely developed and that the benefits outweigh the risk?
Well, certainly that's a very good question about how safe is it. And the long-term side effects of 6 months or a year, of course, obviously you only know those 6 months or a year down the line. Most products, on the other hand, very quickly disappear from the human body. So you take a dose of, Augmentin or whatever product you like, and it sort of disappears. There's a half-life, and within 5, 7, 10 days, it's gone. So most of the side effects for most of the products that we have happen very soon after you take them, in the first few days. And you don't expect, 5 or 10 years later to get a side effect from a product that you had 5 or 10 years earlier. So the general tendency of things to cause problems is in the short and more earlier time. The things that reassure me about safety is that the 44,000 people, that's quite a large number. Other products might be brought to market, for example, with 5 or 8 or 10,000 people who've received it. So it's the size of the trial and the quality of follow-up and the duration of follow-up that really matters.
Okay, but normally it takes about 7 years, doesn't it, to get to a vaccine to the point where it is released on the public, if you like?
In the past, that's the product development time. There's been unprecedented investment and unprecedented hard work in developing a COVID vaccine in 2020, like nothing ever happened before. So hopefully this might be a bit quicker.
And then Claire got personal.
Would you take it, a vaccine that had been developed within 9 months?
I'll be queuing up, Claire. I'll be queuing up.
Will you?
Please give it to me first.
Please give it to me first. That was Professor Sam McConkie with Claire. And when Ray spoke to Professor Luke O'Neill, he asked him to explain this vaccine in the simplest of terms.
How would you describe it to a 10-year-old? Is it like, I was trying to put it, because I have an 8-year-old, I want to explain it to him when I go home this evening.
Yeah.
Is it that you prepare the body with little soldiers that are ready to ambush the virus when it enters your body? Is that it?
Exactly. It's a piece of the virus, a tiny piece of the virus. You inject it into the body and you train the troops, recognize that piece of virus.
Right.
So when the bad virus comes along, the troops can recognize it. It's a bit like putting up wanted posters in the old cowboy movies, The wanted posters are up and now the bad guy arrives and you kill it. That's what this vaccine does, you see. So,
right.
So that's really a good analogy. We don't normally look at science through press releases. Still, they must be confident, right? They've said 90% efficacy. What that means is it will decrease your risk of catching COVID-19 by 90%. Now, again, we're waiting for the data. We'll have to chew over it and so on. But by God, it's a good step, Ray, in the right direction, tell you that much. So we're all very, very excited about this.
And not only is it exciting for what we're going through at the moment, but it's exciting for future generations because this is new technology in the fight against viruses. So this amazing couple, Ugur Sahin and Uzlem Turici, I'm just pretending that that's how you pronounce their names, I don't know if it is, they looked at treatment that's been used to treat cancer and they said, we might be able to use that to vaccine against virus. So we'll explain that to us.
Well, exactly. It's a brand new technology, as you said, Ray, and if it works for COVID-19, you could maybe make a vaccine against many diseases where we haven't got vaccines.
Yes.
Now, it could even be things like malaria, for example. There's still no proper vaccine for malaria, for example. You never know, right? Even the common cold, incredibly, might be vaccinated against, got in the same family as this one. And there is a chance to have vaccines for cancer. So you never know. Pfizer seemed to have cracked it, and if it all works out, of course.
Yes.
Pfizer have invented a really interesting technology. Now, Moderna are a second company. They have a very similar technology. So in other words, that's a second vaccine. So this bodes well for the Moderna vaccine too. So you never know. Before Christmas, you might have two vaccines.
Janie Mac, don't be losing the run of yourself. But again, let's get personal.
Will you take it?
I'd take it now. Right?
Yeah.
I would volunteer for the trial, you know.
Professor Luke O'Neill with Ray. So pretty good news. But with a vaccine so valuable, access to it will be highly politicised. Who gets it and when and at what cost? All questions that were being asked when Sarah McInerney spoke to Suri Moon, co-director of the Global Health Centre at the Graduate Institute in Geneva.
Any COVID-19 vaccine should be seen as a strategic asset, and that's how many governments have been pursuing them. Those who have control over vaccines, such as, we have European companies, we have Chinese and Russian institutes, U.S. companies. I mean, for countries that have control over vaccines, they can be used to strengthen alliances. They can be used to strengthen or weaken, for example, multilateralism. They can be withheld from non-friendly countries. So there are all sorts of ways in which a vaccine can be used as a tool of both diplomacy and international influence. So it's not only a money game.
Oh, maybe not. But if you are broke and can't afford the vaccine, well, then you might become part of the trial.
There are also countries that say, look, we might not have a lot of money or a manufacturing plant, but, clinical trials have to happen somewhere. And so countries that have a lot of cases can partner with companies who need populations in which to, in fact, test the vaccine and try to get access that way. And there's been some recent analysis suggesting that a couple of countries, such as Peru and Mexico, are relying quite heavily on clinical trials to get access to vaccines for their population.
Ooh, that's a difficult place to be. But Sarah McInerney was keeping her eye close to home.
Primarily, this vaccine is going to first benefit people in wealthy, industrialised countries.
Okay, so the US, Japan, UK and Canada, as we've discussed, they're first in line because they have their vaccine secured already. And where would you put the European Union in that list, asking for a friend?
So I don't have any secret information on how far the EU has been negotiating with every major vaccine supplier. And because of the German investment in one of the contributing companies, I would imagine, unless they've negotiated very, very badly, which is possible, I think the EU probably will have access to this vaccine. But because, they need to also consider price. They need to consider how does this vaccine compare to others that they expect to be potentially approved in a similar time frame.
Suri Moon of the Graduate Institute in Geneva on Drive Time. And as the tone indicates, that was a fairly straight take on Monday's news, as befits the national broadcaster. But this is how it felt.
Coconut water, man is good for your daughter. Coconut got candy, make you feel very dandy. One woman told me the other day that no one can take a sweet man away. I asked her what was the mystery. She said coconut water and a rice curry. Coconut got whiskey, make you feel very frisky. Coconut got conch, make you feel very drunk.
Back in a bit. Yay. Welcome back. Wade Darcy was channeling his inner bibliophile this week. On Thursday, he spoke to Ross O'Carroll, Kelly creator Paul Howard and artist Alan Clark, whose illustrations of Oh You're Right had been acquired by the National Library of Ireland. A pretty hefty achievement. But it turned out that not all of their ideas had been good ones.
There's 15, 20 years worth of work there, and more to come all the time.
Including our favourite one, Alan, which is the cover that never happened.
Oh, yes, yeah. There was a cover of Should Have Got Off at Sydney Parade that fell foul of the censors, let's say, and was changed at the very last minute. So it never found its way into the public. So that's
yeah, you have to tell us what it is. One of you, please.
It was based on Demi Moore's famous Vanity Fair photo shoot where she posed pregnant and naked, except it was Ross instead of Demi Moore.
Ah, yeah. I see why good taste took over and let that.
Yeah. What's interesting, Ray, is that it was sent back to us and we were told, you know, people would find this gross. And Alan and I didn't believe them. And it turned out that everybody was right except me and Alan. But I hung a copy of it on the wall in my hallway, and it's been there for 15 years, and everybody comes into the house, looks at it and says, oh my God, that's absolutely disgusting.
And earlier in the week, Ray had spoken to Artemis Fowl creator Owen Colfer about his new book, The Fowl Twins.
I'm constantly amazed by you. You know, I'm just looking at the list of books that you've written, and I know I say it to you every time, but it's just, does it just spew out of your brain? Is it like
spew? That's the word I want on the cover of the next book in the quote. It spews out of him. I work really hard, and it's a job for me. You know, I'd sit down 8 hours a day and write, and out of that 8 hours, I might get 1,000 words. So that's not bad. But I've been doing it for 35 years, and for as many hours a day as I can. So I treat it like a real job. And that's because I actually had a real job for 15 years. So I know what it's like to have to work for a living. So I'd rather not do that. So I just keep writing.
And then the question we're all asking, how's your lockdown?
I think Ireland has become a much nicer, kinder and better place during lockdown. And you really notice that when you're out and about and watching people caring for each other. And I'll tell you one thing. The amount of little tiny kids that are amazing on bicycles now. If we don't win the Tour de France in 15 years, I will be very... Like, these little two-year-olds are flying around, and they're fantastic.
Yeah. The lockdown generation.
Yeah.
It'll be a phenomenon.
Owen Colfer with Ray. However, for Tommy Tiernan, who was chatting to Brendan on Saturday, all of the isolation and tedium of the restrictions had not been that enjoyable. But he did have a treat lined up for the day.
So just to have an event to look forward to. So it's say today now, you know, I have a load of logs to put into a pile and I'm looking forward to that.
You're joking. I was going to say to you, like, you know, casually, are you chopping wood for the winter? But you actually are.
Well, I know the wood has already been chopped, but I have to put it into a pile. It was dropped on the gravel and now I have to take it off the gravel and put it on the kind of the raised level we have beside the deck.
Okay, that's going to justify a day, is it?
Well, I spend a day talking about it and then a day doing it and then about a week talking about the fact that I've done it. But I'd be looking forward to, there's a soccer game on at lunchtime, there's GAA on this afternoon, there's a bit more soccer on tomorrow. So it's small things like that that I realise I really look forward to these things, and there might be trivial or shallow is the wrong word, but they're so kind of, I might have looked down on them before and said, oh, I should be interested in things that are a bit more worthy. But I realise how important these little things are.
Oh, Tommy, too lethargic to even chop the logs? Well, spare a thought for Brendan O'Connor. She wouldn't know where to go from there.
Yeah, you're like a fella actually who had an all-encompassing kind of addiction that controlled your whole life. And it was kind of, everything was built around that being on the road, wasn't it, in a way? And now you've stopped and you're seeing all this other stuff properly?
Yeah, but I still want to get back on the crack.
Yeah, this is it. We'll tell ourselves for the time being that we're looking forward to moving the wood. But let's face it, as soon as we have other options, we're out of here, baby.
Tommy with Brendan on Saturday. Now, who gets commemorated and why was up for a very sparky discussion on Drive Time on Wednesday. A proposal to erect 3 statues in Cork City to celebrate Irish revolutionaries was voted down by councillors because there were no female representatives. Well, Shane O'Callaghan from Fine Gael had brought the proposal.
I have no issue or no problem whatsoever with a monument or statue being erected to commemorate a notable woman or women of the period. I even suggested that the Wallace sisters, Sheila and Nora Wallace, as an example. But my suggestion was not, unfortunately, taken up. And look, I also think that opposing my proposal just because none of the 3 statues is of a woman is, quite frankly, taking political correctness a little bit too far. Mm. Collins, McCurtain and McSweeney were 3 exceptional Cork figures of the period, both in terms of what they achieved and the fact that they all died tragically between 1920 and 1922, and the fact that none of them happened to be a woman is, in my view, not a good enough reason for opposing the motion.
Independent Councillor Kieran McCarthy was also on the line, and he had opposed the proposal.
It's just too much. I mean, to have four male statues on one street.
Can I just be clear, Kieran, in terms of...
I'm not feminist in any way, but I just couldn't support it.
Sorry, did you say you're no feminist in any way?
Yeah, look, but I mean, the interesting thing about Cork history is that it's a very masculine history. I mean, I give walking tours and I write books on the city's history, on Cork City's history, and I've been doing that for over 25 years. And for the most part, it's a male-dominated history. And over the last 10 years, more and more the city is looking towards celebrating its female historical characters. And more and more we're kind of balancing up the gender part of our history. And I think that's actually highly important.
Kieran McCarthy. And it fell to Sarah McInerney to do some schooling in feminism. Buckle up, Shane.
You're the one who put down the motion. So when you put down the motion, did you not think, well, perhaps we might have two men and one woman? Or take a breath and think maybe two women and one man? And even on Patrick Street. Did it occur to you?
Okay, Sarah, but again, you have to put things in context. Michael Collins, in his short life, led the military resistance to British rule, ran the finances of the outlawed Dáil government during war.
Thank you for explaining this to me, Shane.
But unfortunately, women were you know, in many ways, well, in reality, they were second-class citizens at the time. And obviously, that is something that was a terrible, one of the many injustices that occurred in the time in Ireland and across the world. But because of that fact, the main leaders of the independence movement at the time were were people like Michael Collins, people like Tomás McCurtain, people like Terence McSweeney, and to just say, okay, well, we won't commemorate, have a statue of one of them because they weren't a woman. I don't think that's a good enough reason, to be honest. And look, if you look at any major city in the world, you will see statues of heroes from their past. Yeah. Okay? I mean, for instance, yeah, O'Connell Street in Dublin.
Is this not the problem, though? Is this not the problem? If you look at any city in the world, you'll see statues, and you'll see male statues everywhere, and you'll see male names on signposts everywhere, and you'll see bridges called after men everywhere. And young women growing up are looking around and wondering, were women even alive? Did they do anything? And if they did, why are they not being commemorated? You're talking about women being second-class citizens back then. Are you not perpetuating that now by refusing to commemorate, or not in, when you think about putting down a motion to build some statues, by not thinking, well, let's put the Wallace sisters in there and let's put them on a pedestal?
But again, Sarah, I suggested that last night.
You've been working on your motion about the three men for a year.
And it wasn't taken up.
Oh, steam rising in Studio 10. There was more.
It sounds to me like you've realised now that maybe we should commemorate women in some way or another, but you've only just realised that now. And even now, when the point is being made to you that maybe it might not be the best thing to have four men on Patrick Street when there are no women, you're still saying, well, no, the men are more important. That's effectively what you're saying, because they were the leaders and they are more important. Is that what you're saying?
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that... I had a proposal, right, that three seminal Cork figures of the period would be commemorated. I'm totally, you know, in favour of commemorating women and recognising women's achievements. I'm all for that, but I mean...
But let's get the male statues up first. But let's get the male statues up first.
Well, not let's get the male statues up first, but I mean, you have to look at history in the context of who played the biggest role in the period. And like, do you know, I mean, it was, in my view, the outstanding figure of the period was Michael Collins. I mean, right. Because he happens to be a man, does that make him, you know, does he deserve
poor old Michael Collins, you know, there's not enough commemorating of Michael Collins done, you know, around the country. There's not enough statues, and there's not enough bridges, and there's not enough signposts around Michael Collins.
I mean, at the moment, I mean, for someone who played such a huge role in his very short life, I don't think there is enough.
Ooh, no one to quit, sir. That was Fine Gael's Shane O'Callaghan with Sarah McInerney on Drive Time. Now, as we scratch off the days on the Level 5 Advent calendar, the question has been asked as to whether it's advisable for people to come home from abroad for Christmas. And with the new EU traffic light system, is it time to rethink our ideas around quarantine and travel? On Wednesday, Claire spoke to Tomás Ryan, Assistant Professor at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College.
So far, our travel situation has not been working because it hasn't been enforced. Now, there is a view that travel really mattered at the beginning of the pandemic, and since then, our second wave came out of community transmission. That's simply not true. We know now that over 60% of the COVID-19 in Ireland are derived from a Spanish variant that wasn't here before the summer. And probably a lot that we don't know about as well has come from other countries in Europe. This has been seen in many parts of Europe, including Great Britain. So travel has significantly seeded the current situation and is very largely responsible as a major factor as to why we're in a second lockdown. Everything else we're doing, social distancing, mask wearing, being in lockdown now, and the pressure on our test trace isolation infrastructure, our public health doctors and our frontline health workers, we're all paying for an ineffective travel screening system. And the important thing to remember is that testing works for isolation. Everything we do works for isolation because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to isolate people. Now, if we have a system at the moment where we are not enforcing quarantine and clearly people are not quarantining sufficiently, then we're just talking about reducing the time of restrictions that enough people are not observing in the first place. So I don't see that in itself as being a positive step. We need to look at countries that have kept things under control. Every single country that has managed to heavily suppress or eliminate the COVID-19 transmission in the community has done so by properly managing its borders with enforced mandatory quarantine.
And then on Thursday, this.
I think in terms of people booking flights for Christmas to come home, I advise them not to do that at the moment. I know that's difficult. I know that's tough. But Christmas is 6 weeks away and it's too soon now, I think, for people to be booking flights to come home.
As you might expect, Liveline callers had something to say on the matter. Here's John from Saudi Arabia.
Well, Joe, I booked my first flight to come home for April for my dad's 82nd birthday, and I had to keep cancelling it because I was following guidelines, and also we were in lockdown in Saudi Arabia. Anybody who travels home long distance books their flights significantly in advance. We are also subject to very strict rules for travel, i.e. a PCR test before we travel.
Okay.
But that, I'm missing the point. I'm of the opinion, I remember what has kept me sane is Christmas and Irish radio, because we have lived in, I haven't seen my family since February. My parents are elderly in Cork. They're in their 80s and I wanted to visit them. I'm one quite ill. I haven't seen my own children. The Irish expatriate people we're all very lonely. We're missing our family. Mm-hmm. We do not want to bring COVID to Ireland. I'm very, very happy to be subject to any PCR test, to be subject to any form of quarantine. But please don't tell me I can't come home after 10 months.
But others were not so keen to roll out the Cathaid Míle Fáilte. Not this year, anyway.
I was livid listening to people there talking about, you know, they want their family to come in from another country. My sister lives 40 miles away from me in Dublin. I've seen her twice over the summer, kind of once a month, with my only niece and nephew I have. And we haven't gone into our parents' house once since March.
Wow.
And these people are talking about flying into airports to come into this country when people like me and my close niche family have not gone into our parents' house because we're following the guidelines. So I'm absolutely livid that people think they can come in.
Liveline on Thursday, and this, I suspect, is just the start of it. Ryan Tuberty spoke to 9-year-old Lottie Billington from Westport in County Mayo. Her drawing of a peacock had won a prize, and it was quite the prize.
Well, I entered a competition for a J.K. Rowling book for the illustrations of it over lockdown.
Yeah.
And there were 18,000 entries.
Say that again. How many?
18,000.
18,000 little hands around the world drawing pictures for J.K. Rowling for the hard copy edition of the book that she'd been writing for children over lockdown, and you decided I'm going to draw a picture?
Yeah.
Okay.
And there was 38 winners and I was one of them.
Oh, for goodness sake. Get the applause in here immediately. Listen to the whoops and cheers and holler. An artist. What a skill.
And you can see that drawing online and it's really good. But she wasn't just a very fine artist. She and her sister Rosie were pretty good kids, as their mother Sarah testified. Their father Mal had died when they were very young, but they did their best to remember him.
You were very little when your dad died, isn't that right?
Yeah.
And do you remember how you felt at that time?
I was very sad, but our uncle made us teddies out of my dad's clothes, and Mom made a book with pictures of my dad and us in it.
And when do you look at that book?
When we're feeling sad.
And what does the book do for you, for your heart and for your mind?
It really helps.
Ah, no. And they had a particularly thoughtful way of remembering their father's birthday. And steady yourself for this one.
On my dad's birthday, we always go to a coffee shop and buy hot drinks for the next 10 people that come in.
I have to say, Ryan, that was their idea. Again, it's the learning that we get from, that I get, that I have gotten from Lottie and Rosie has been amazing. I mean, they were only 3 and 4, but when it was coming up to his first birthday, we just had a chat about what he liked and the way he was. And they said hot drinks, which was something we used to slag Mal about being English. He used to say, would you like a hot drink? Instead of saying, would you like tea or coffee? So they came up with the plan. And I think, you know, if a lot of adults stood back and gave kids the space that they need to teach us, we could learn a lot from them.
Can I ask you, Lottie, a question?
Yeah.
You know when you decided you wanted to do something nice for your dad's anniversary?
Yeah.
Why did you decide on the hot drinks? Now, your mum has described it a little bit, but I'd like to know from you, because you were very young at that time. It's a very big thing to do. It's a very kind, big-hearted thing to do. Can you tell me what you were thinking?
Well, we knew our dad was very kind and he loved buying people hot drinks and things, and so we just decided to do that, and his favourite coffee shop was Mocha, so we went there every year, and I hope we can do it this year because of lockdown.
So you pay, is that what you do? You give them the money for 10 hot drinks and then the next 10 people randomly come in and they get them free because it's in your dad's memory?
Yeah, me and Rosie use our pocket money.
Oh, I don't know if I'm able for the pair of you today. It's no, but you know what it is? I feel like Willy Wonka at the end of the film, you know, when he talks about a chink of light and a world gone mad, you know, it's... Sarah, you're proud, but I think this sort of kindness is contagious.
Yeah, I think you're right, Ryan, and it feels a very real way of spreading Mal's kindness when we do that. You say I'm proud. There aren't words to really describe how I feel about them and how blessed and lucky I am to have them in my life. And yeah, Mal very much lives on in both of his girls.
What a lovely story. That was Sarah Billington with Lottie and Rosie talking to Ryan on Wednesday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Wednesday, November 11th, hereafter ever known as Wild Mountain Thyme Day.
Will you call us
have ever had a dream since you were a child and you couldn't let it go?
So you put this gate between us.
Has your dream made you happy or miserable?
You kissed him!
It was he that kissed me!
That's what's got him worked up!
I don't understand you people. Why do you make everything so hard? You just seem to accept these crazy things.
I don't like a fight.
Well, who does?
Half of Ireland, just not me.
If my true love, he were gone.
Get down, me shillelagh shimmy. Because pretty much every single radio programme on the station broke out the bagaras and the bagobs.
Our arts, media, and possibly for one day only, crime correspondent Sinead Crowley is with us. Top of the morning to you, Sinead. Tell us more about Wild Mountain Thyme.
It's a grand soft day here, Gavin. Delighted to be talking to you this morning. I have never seen such a reaction to a trailer. Now, we have to point out, we have only seen the trailer, right? So maybe the trailer is misleading. Maybe this is going to be the greatest depiction of emotion ever since Normal People, and we'll have to come back and take it all back. But judging by the trailer, this is going to be a classic of a very different type. Just again, by the trailer, we have star-crossed lovers, we have a row over land, we have a visiting Yank, we have a woman who goes to New York and bursts into tears because apparently she's never sat inside a theatre before. We've a woman wearing a shawl. Like, they're all there, and that's just in a short trailer, and that's before we even go near the accents, which includes Christopher Walken playing the kind of the field character and trying to figure out who inherits this famous piece of land outside Mullingar, which is apparently where it's all set. We've had Ryanair tweeting, we've had Dublin Airport tweeting, we've even had the Leprechaun Museum tweeting that, you know, this movie is probably going a bit too far.
Fairness, balance and accuracy from the Leprechaun Museum? But this was the gift of the gab that just kept on giving. Next up, Ryan.
They seem to have brought the quiet man's ancient history of beauty, dragged it through a prism of decades of time, forgotten that maybe electricity was created and that the internet exists, and now have this strange story of... Would you look at him, Father? What are you doing at all? I mean, you would expect Bing Crosby to be drafted in as the local priest. It is amazing. And the accents are extraordinary. And I don't know what it is. And I can't knock it. I don't want to anyway. Because I haven't seen it. In fact, nobody has seen it. We're just judging on trailers, which isn't fair. So until we see the whole thing, we can't judge it.
Ah, yeah, we can. And we will. Cue Claire Byrne, who was joined by film producer Brian Redden.
How many days do we have while the sun shines?
It's not shining.
I believe that it is.
I don't want to be mean, because like, we haven't seen this movie. Brian, what is that?
What indeed. And the Yanks? They couldn't give a hoot. And we've only ourselves to blame.
This is not going to matter. Like when they make this film, they're not making it for an Irish audience. Yeah. They're making it for an American audience. Two American audiences, they don't know what an Irish accent really sounds like, because they've been reared on a diet of stage Irish buffoonery from right back in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. And like, where's to blame for this? Anybody else? Because like, I mean, you go back to The Quiet Man in 1952, Barry Fitzgerald, who's born and reared in the north side of Dublin, Maureen O'Hara, who's from Ranelagh. I mean, they're in The Quiet Man speaking in accents that don't exist in any part of the country. So we kind of fed the Yanks this accent that they now believe is the Irish accent. So anything that deviates from that, they'll go, what the hell is that?
And you can't talk about the Irish without this R. Oh no, that's pirate. Sorry.
Why can't you say it, Shannon? Why can't you say you like my hat? Why can't you say you like my suit? I've earned this. I've done well.
Tom Cruise, like, what does he care what people in Boise, Idaho think, you know?
But that did really well. The Farnaway did really well. It's like, you know,
Farnaway did really well, yeah. Farnaway was a lot of these films we're talking about, like P.S. I Love You and Leap Year and all these films that really mangle the Irish accent, do very well outside of Ireland. And that's what matters at the end of the day. These production companies, and like, they're not going to make their money back in Ireland. So they don't really care what the Irish audiences think. It's what the guys think in Boise, Idaho. What's he going to think when he comes in? He's not going to say, God, Jamie Dornan's accent's terrible. He's going to enjoy the movie for what it is, you know?
Did they mention Jamie Dornan? Because when Liveline opened the faders, of course they did. When self-confessed Jamie Dornan megafan phoned in to Joe, even she conceded that perhaps his appeal in this one was primarily visual. And by the way, the film was shot in Mayo.
He's from Belfast and he can't do a Mayo accent.
That looks to be the case.
And Arla, would you have given him a few lessons?
I would have personally coached him if I'd been approached. No bother at all.
And you worked, you would have worked down his throat and his gutturals and his...
Definitely.
Yes.
Yeah, he'd have had the best Mayo accent.
The best Mayo accent.
I had been approached.
Come here, tell me how the nearest I've been to Neffin is Crowpatrick. But it's not, it's my vague memory, it's not pronounced Neffin, is it? It is up in Dublin, there's Neffin Road and various parts
well,
of Dublin.
Neffin. Neffin.
And you would have said to Jamie Collin, Neffin. Oh, Jamie, come here to me, Jamie.
So we're hoping.
You know
hoping
what you need to improve. Let me whisper into your ear, Jamie, and I'll tell you how to improve your Mayo accent. And there's our other mooching up to him. Oh, God, what's the aftershave, Jamie? And Jamie says, you're a bum on the farm all day and night. Orly, do you want to hear Jamie's accent once more? Would you brace yourself?
Oh,
brace yourself.
If I have to, yeah.
Oh, talk yourself through it. Hey, Jamie.
There's these green fields. And there's us, whatever that is, it holds me here.
At the green fields, Arla, and then there's us. And whatever that is, Arla, it holds me here. Don't be going off with that yank, the big John Ham. He's a ham of a man and a ham of an actor, Arla. Don't leave me for Brooklyn. Don't leave me for Manhattan.
Oh. Sweet mother of the divine, John Ham wasn't the only one chomping down on the Denny slices there. Darcy, on the other hand, took a more forensic approach, and he spoke to voice coach Paul Mosolidis.
Here's what I think goes wrong most of the time. Here's something for you. Will you say to me, where were you?
Where were you?
Okay, so now, in some accents you get, where were you? You know, like the
yes.
Where and the where, the where and the were are the same. Where were you?
Yeah.
Some people might make the H in the where a little bit. So, like, Dublin people tend to go, like, where were you?
Right.
Now, if you're doing a fake Dublin accent or you're trying to do a Dublin accent, I think this is where, and this is what probably happened in this film and other films, is that if you try to put too much air into it and suddenly you're going, where are you? And before you know it, you're going, oh, when he says those things... And suddenly, you know, the rhythm is almost one beat at a time and there's lots of air. And the accent is actually correct underneath it.
Yeah.
But anything that you say with that kind of air coming through your mouth sounds ridiculous because nobody talks like that.
Sure, don't you sound great there, Paul, doing the Irish accent.
It's wonderful.
Oh, sure now. Well, the hands of the clock were moving on. The big hands were creeping up to the 7 with the small following behind. Surely you would think drive time would leave it alone. Not on your Nelly. Here's Cormac doing Jamie. And then trained actor, I'll say that one more time, trained actor Sean Rocks.
I'm actually from 120 miles from where the movie set is, Mikushla. And Emily... There's an ocean between her and where the movie set is.
No,
Irish Sea, certainly. He's... Tooraloo. Say Tooraloo.
Arena with Sean Rocks is on the way after the news from all of us here in Drive Time. Have a great evening.
Well, indeed, and sure, isn't it great to be here in Cormac and Sarah there to be talking about the accents in the Irish films. Well, we...
Will you call a seagull?
Ah, big gar, but it's going we'd be. For that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.